You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. This is episode 180. I'm your co-host, Mark Newbold, and joining me today is a man who is to X-Wing suits what Ned Flanders is to ski suits. Mark, how are you doing?
I'll be honest, I think Ned Flanders has got me beat when it comes to looking good in a ski suit, and probably an X-Wing pilot suit.
It's the crossover we never knew we needed, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think we're ever going to get, luckily.
How's it going? We're in Fordingbridge at the moment. The weather's holding.
Yes. Do you know what? Considering it was like a torrential downpour, I thought I was going to arrive in Mimban or somewhere. This place is nice and kind of sunny.
It is.
It's clear blue sky, so it's getting a little bit fresh, but it's not too bad. And it's still warmer than the last time I was here, and that was really cold. But still, it's Fordingbridge. It's for Father's From weekend, so it's a fun time for everyone who is in the area.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been nice and busy downstairs. Plenty of people here from the various costuming groups. There was Anne.
And
induction this morning. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So for those who follow the site, they would have seen that Fantha Tracks has published and promoted Pablo Hidalgo as appearing at Fathers From this weekend. And so we figured it's probably only fair and right that we take the opportunity to induct Pablo into the Rebel Legion, because he is a man who's very hard to pin down. Mm. And so I was surprised when I went to look at the long list of Rebel Legion honorary members, whether or not he'd been inducted, and it turns out he hadn't. And that's basically not through lack of trying, that's just because he's either at celebration and super busy and tied down to stuff, or he doesn't do many appearances. No. So, you know, the fact that he's here at Fordingbridge, it's like a double bonus, because we've got our book signed, got the new Dawn of the Rebellion book signed by Pablo, and also we managed to chuck a load of acrylic plastic in his in his lap and welcome him into Rebel Legion.
So first interview is the one we remember. Elstree Mace, how do you feel?
I feel honoured. I mean, you can't get more historic than Elstree in Star Wars, right?
Very true.
So yeah, I'm going to find a proud place at my on my work desk for a lot of these accolades.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Congratulations. Thank you so much.
Although he doesn't know this yet, we're going to induct Mr. Dave Tree as a friend of Elstree Base as well. So once we've found him and pinned him down, and we can chuck some acrylic his way as
it
well.
It says a lot that it's probably easier to find Pablo Hidalgo at Fordingbridge Fathers From than it is to find Dave, isn't it?
It is. I think that's testament as to how busy he is, and also the fact that all the cool stuff is literally opposite the main site for the event, and so he is literally dashing between the two.
Dashing, perfect word for Christmas. I'm literally looking at all the cool stuff because we're upstairs at Fordingbridge Town Hall. I'm also looking at the room I'm staying in over at the ship, which is weird and means nothing to people who listen to podcasts.
No,
but it makes me happy.
Wow!
So you're now a member of the Elstree Base, Dave. How does it feel?
Amazing. Thank you. Oh, that's so cool. Oh, thanks very much, guys. Thank you.
Today is the first day. It's the family day, the kids' day. It's always fun when you have Star Wars events that are kid-focused.
Yes.
There's the games going on, all the other stuff that's happening. You guys get out to a lot of that stuff.
That's true. Yeah, we do. And we kind of leave the serious collecting stuff to the Sunday, and we don't tend to do those. Because, to be fair, the people who turn up for that, A, have probably seen us in a billion other events, but also they're there for the lovely vintage luxury gold. So then they're not necessarily wanting to stop for photos. They're more wanting to kind of like fight over vinyl Cape Jowers and blue Snaggletooths.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Even though we're at Farthest From, a beautiful place to be, this is a regular episode of Making
It
Tracks.
Is.
We have a bit of news.
We do.
Should we dive into it?
Let's do it.
So, the director of Godzilla Minus One, it's broke all the records in the US box office charts for being the highest grossing Japanese film, certainly on its opening weekend. And its director, Takashi Yamazaki, has said that he would love to get involved in another genre. He'd love to move from the Godzilla universe into the Star Wars universe, a bit like Gareth Edwards, if you think about it.
I was thinking that.
Also being a guy who has done films on a budget and brought it in to look like a blockbuster, Minus One cost $15 million. Gareth has just gone and done The Creator, which cost, for Hollywood, a piddling $80 million, and this has crossed the $100 million barrier worldwide as well. What do you make of that? Do you think it's a good thing that we can see directors move from one franchise to the other, especially something like Godzilla, which has got all the scope, all the spectacle? It's a big-looking movie. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it gives the franchise a little bit of interesting direction, I think. And like you said, Gareth Edwards is probably the prime example of that. The movies they did before that, was it Monsters? Is that what it's called?
Monsters,
that was done for, like, a bag of Haribo.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily, like, about the fact that they can't work on to scale. Yeah. It's actually about having the creative vision. And also, you've got to remember, like, a director's doing a number of things. Obviously, they're the creative driving force behind many of it. They've also got to know and have a decent rapport with actors. It's also been able to kind of take that change and step up in scope with their strides. So,
and it's an interesting parallel. Yamazaki is also, as well as being the director, he's also the VFX director as well, which, again, you mentioned Monsters. That's what Gareth did on Monsters.
Right,
he comes from a VFX background. With effects budgets being high anyway, but with movie budgets being astronomical at the moment, and Disney, as we've mentioned, having not the best year in terms of hits and return on massive investment, do you think it's a smart move for Lucasfilm? Not that they've announced anything to do with this guy. It's just all speculative. He's just put it out there. Did he like to do it? Do you think it will be a sensible thing to bring in people like that who can oversee budgets, or rather work to tighter budgets? That's what I'm saying, you know, to bring in a visually spectacular movie on a lower budget.
Yeah, I mean, for movie, yes. I mean, let's be fair. Star Wars was done for $11 million, you know, back in 76. I mean, yeah, I don't know what that would now be in today's money. However, it might still be quite a lot less than, you know, the average kind of $250, $300 million, like, VFX budget. It's having the director who is in touch with VFX in that way means that they're comfortable working in the workflow. They're not going to immediately jump to, oh, we can do that in the volume. They're going to look at maybe more practical ways of doing it, or more kind of artistic ways whereby, you know, take Spielberg and Jaws, for example, you know, the machine didn't work, so therefore you've got to pivot and shoot in a slightly different way. But I think also pulling in these directors who aren't mainstream means that actually it could just create an interesting kind of shift in the dynamics with directors. And obviously, studio directors, you get two types. You get the auteur, who have very much got the vision, they write, and then they direct. And then you've got these kind of journeyman directors. Mm. And pretty much they're the ones who tend to do more for TV. They're involved in the story, but basically the story has already been broken beforehand. And so they're there just to kind of, like, get the thing made. So there's two very different schools of, like, how you, you know, approach filmmaking. Neither is better than the other. They just create different end results. And I think Star Wars needs probably a little bit of both, because actually, whilst we're focusing on the movies, there's still going to be Disney Plus streaming shows.
True. That's a good point. We did a bit of number crunching on the site in this article, and we worked out that six episodes of Secret Invasion from Marvel on Disney Plus, as you say, cost $212 million. That's enough to make Godzilla Minus One 14 times over.
There you go. Yeah, rest your case, you know. And I suppose you also need to start to look at the time as well. When you've got such a small budget, you're calling in, obviously, favours a little bit, and you're working on a lot more people's goodwill. Does that translate? If you're like, hey, you know, we're making a Star Wars film, but we've only got 25 million, I'm pretty sure most people would be like, okay, that's great, I want to work on Star Wars. However, you still work for Disney and Lucasfilm, we know you're not broke.
And it's an interesting thought that you go back to George when he was looking at making the prequel trilogy, and of course the OT was huge, but there'd been a sizable gap between the two trilogies, and so he gets the Pepsi deal, which was astronomical, you know, and that helps fund the prequels and off the back of the special editions. That world doesn't exist to that degree anymore, does it?
No, I mean, especially in franchise stuff, the tie-ins don't seem to work. Now, I don't know if that's more of something that's like the whole industry, or if it's just maybe more something to do with how Disney operates, because they themselves kind of, you know, are their own franchise, really, you know, and so their tie-ins are tie-ins with the parks and stuff like that, you know. I mean, but I do miss a good McDonald's Happy Meal, you know, to get the kids' toys and stuff.
I want my plastic Jar Jar on the top of my milkshake.
Right. Still get those for the cinemas, you know.
That's true.
Those still kind of coming. But again, they're not kind of promoted in the same level to what they did back, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And that's probably just a shift in, but things have moved on. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what a low budget indie kind of director can do in the Star Wars sphere, and also maybe interesting in a really kind of like perverse way, how that might corrupt the kind of vision that he has.
Hello, I'm Dennis Lawson, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So if you're lucky enough to be in London between the 8th and 30th of December, then you will have the chance to see all six episodes of the original and prequel trilogies play at the Prince Charles Cinema just off Leicester Square. Starting on the 8th of December with A New Hope, it plays on the 11th, the 15th, 26th and 30th, but weirdly not on the 27th, which is the anniversary of the UK arrival
of
Star Wars, which is a strange decision, but hey-ho. Empire on the 26th and 30th, Jedi on the 26th and 30th, and then Phantom Menace on the 27th. Mm-hmm. The Attack of the Clones also on the 27th, and Revenge of the Sith, so they're doing a trilogy day for the prequel trilogy. How intensely cool is that? If you've got the opportunity to be in London to see these classics on the big screen, what a chance.
If you haven't been to the Prince Charles Theatre, it's well worth a visit because it's kind of a very old school theatre. It's something very unique. There's a kind of charity aspect to it as well, so that's also good. And ticket prices aren't too bad. You know, if you are local and you become a member, then they're even cheaper.
One of the cool things, though, is that they're obviously screening both trilogies. We would happily chew them up and eat them in any format, but they're being shown in 4K, which is a bit special to see them in that cinema as well.
Yeah, I mean, 4K is, I mean, obviously they've probably taken the 4K versions that we can see on Disney Plus and all that. However, you know, nobody's got like a 30-foot or 20-foot cinema screen in their house. And if they do, then obviously they're doing a lot better than you or I. So, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's like we can watch Star Wars every day, which is great. We can watch it on our phones, we can watch it on our tablets, on our laptops, on our TVs. But seeing it at the cinema is always that extra special thing because, you know, you hear the fanfare, you hear, you know, the music and the bass rumble when you know, the Death Star fires that Alderaan in a way that you don't tend to do if you're just watching it on a tinny little kind of like 6-inch device.
It's very true. It just strikes me that Star Wars originally came out in 77, December 27th, down at, I think, Tottenham Court Road, the Dominion.
Yeah.
You know, and a couple of screens, only a couple of cinemas that showed it. The amount of people who swear blind that they saw Star Wars
amazing,
in 1977 is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, bearing in mind, like, such a small window of opportunity, and yeah, loads of people did. But it's funny, isn't it? I can, you know, there's people who swear blind they saw versions where there was, like, extended versions with big, you know, deleted scenes in it and stuff like that. And it's just one of those weird psychological kind of, like, fallacies which kind of seems to go on.
Exactly, and we had that for years, didn't we? Because there was the storybook that had the pictures of Tosche Station and all that in it. I think that kind of got mixed up in people's minds, didn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose that's the thing, is like, you know, really, with Star Wars, more than anything, you know, Star Wars was kind of released and really kind of ushered in the home cinema, like, wave of entertainment. And so, you know, but still, it took a few years for people to have seen Star Wars and then see it on VHS.
Totally, 5 years before it came to home video.
Yeah, exactly. And, okay, some people managed to see it, like, you know, 10, 15 or 40 times in the cinema. But, like, most people probably would have only seen it a couple of times. And, and that's where those kind of weird kind of, like, confusions happen. How many times did you see it at the cinema when you first came out?
I saw it, the original, which would have been sort of Easter 78. I didn't see it again on the big screen until, wow, I didn't see the double bill. I missed the double bill. It would have been the triple bill in 83.
Right. Wow.
So then since then, a few times when it's been re-released, obviously special editions and such. The last time I saw the original version on the big screen was 92. Our local cinema in Tamworth did a screening of the original. Yeah. And then after that, it was all special edition stuff.
Yeah.
But original run just twice.
Yeah, see, that's two more times than I have, because I've only seen the special edition on the big screen. You know, and I saw A New Hope 14 times in 97.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a decent run. So Empire 18 times, and then Jedi back to a measly 14 in a shocking
slacker.
Yeah. So you can see where I spent my summer holidays that year anyway. So one of those things, isn't it? You know, I mean, it'd still be good. I mean, it's a shame that they don't kind of do, you know, even a very limited release of, like, just for 4K.
Well, that's true. I mean, this year with Jedi being 40, there was that screening earlier, sort of April, May time. Mm-hmm. A bunch of Fantha Trackers did a screening down in Birmingham, and it was so cool because there was Garrison and Rebel Legion people there and all sorts of folks. Just a great atmosphere, and the chance to see Jedi on the big screen again is always very, very welcome. you just kind of feel with Star Wars, it's one of those franchises where if they did that every, not every year, but, you know, fairly regularly, they'd get a good turnout.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's the same as when they do, like, the Royal Albert Hall, Dolls Music in Concert, that kind of thing. Again, that's, like, that's a different way of seeing it, but it's also something very, very cool and unique. And, I mean, it comes back to, like, a theme that we've been talking about for, really, the last 6 months or a year. It's about, you know, making Star Wars an event. And it is still, even, like, 44 kind of years later, it's still an event when it does actually kind of appear at cinema, even if it's only one cinema in London.
Hi, this is Gareth Edwards, director of the best standalone Star Wars film since Caravan of Courage, called Rogue One. You're listening to Panther Tracks. Enjoy.
The Boys, which is a smash hit on Amazon Prime, is looks set to get a Spanish language spin-off from executive producer Diego Luna, who may be joining the project possibly as an on-screen talent. With shows that are big hits in the UK and the States and English language countries that are then presumably either dubbed or subtitled into other countries in the same way that we get Squid Games, let's say. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a logical thing to take that location, and obviously Spanish-speaking location that Mexico is, to do a Mexican spin-off that we then watch dubbed and subtitled, whatever your choice may be? To me, that seems an obvious idea that no one's ever really cottoned onto, certainly for something like The Boys, which is set here on Earth now. Maybe not so logical if it's a Star Wars project, because that's not set here, it's set somewhere else. But what do you think of that? And also Diego getting involved, which seems pretty cool.
See, me encanto Los Niños. Yeah, I guess a little bit of a Spaniel.
Love it.
I mean, it's quite an interesting take, isn't it? I mean, I suppose that's the thing. I mean, because it's weird to kind of go that way. It does tend to be like the English-speaking versions of the versions that kind of get converted from, you know, like a foreign language version. They do a remake because they think it's going to be more special. And it's always that thing, isn't it? Like, will it translate? Are they going to do almost like a direct lift, or are they going to basically go, well, it's kind of like The Boys, kind of, you know, and is it going to appeal more to this Latin American audience for various reasons? You know, this day and age, it's, you know, with Netflix and that, and you've got the option to, you know, listen in native with subtitles or like dubbed and stuff, it kind of almost seems like a bit of a cash grab, because, like, you know, I think, I mean, I don't know how much like foreign language like shows you watch, but like, for example, Karen's not a huge fan of listening to, like, say, Squid Games with the English, you know, she much prefer to listen to, like, the native with the subtitles. Yeah. And that's kind of the same thing with Spanish. I can remember when I was out in Venezuela a lot, they would much prefer to have the English and then the Spanish subtitles than, like, a dodgy naff Spanish dub. Because also sometimes, you know, the nuance gets lost in the translation, the way you have to truncate a sentence or extend a sentence. And we do this a lot at Sky. We get a lot of German and Italian shows in that we do subtitles to and stuff. Yeah. And you kind of look at what is said versus what is actually on screen.
Yeah.
And you have to truncate it, or you have to try and extend it, or the translation is completely arse about tip. It's, I mean, it's a nice idea. There must be a real kind of strong reason for doing it beyond the fact that they just want to make a bit of money off of maybe Pedro and that vehicle.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd watch it, and I'd watch it in Spanish.
It's interesting when Law & Order, which has had like a billion spin-offs and then some.
Yeah, yeah, 6 or 7.
They did Law & Order UK.
Yes.
Which kind of remade some of the American stuff, but rejigged it for the UK market. Yeah. And you've got, you know, Bradley Walsh in it and a few other familiar faces and such. It lasted a couple of seasons and did okay. But you just wonder if they do these spin-offs so they're part of the universe and part of that world, certainly with something like The Boys, but set it in other countries, because why not? This stuff's happening all around the world.
It's a global thing, yeah.
It might work.
It could work. And then I suppose if they then start looking at, say, you know, the uptake and, you know, where people are watching it, you kind of wonder, like, how many people from the US would watch that, and obviously quite a lot, because there's a lot of Spanish speaking residents in the US. So therefore then you can go, well, if it's in the same universe, crossover, you know, it's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And that would be quite fun, because again, that then draws people in, and it might be that you've got fans of The Boys in Spain that haven't watched the American version and are like, oh, okay, actually that's cool.
Yeah.
So it's another way, it's another avenue that you can entice people.
And it's a smart thing for Diego to move from being in the Star Wars franchise for a while and now to move across to another massive franchise with The Boys, which is getting bigger because Gen V was huge. They've done some animated stuff. It's edgy, it's 18 clearly, but it seems like a smart move.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite a fun and unique little franchise that's kind of developing, which we haven't really had like an X-Men film for quite a few years, really, in the purest sense, and they are quite sanitized and that, and the same as Marvel. So having this kind of like this more edgy superhero stuff, which obviously, you know, there are lots of edgy and graphic kind of comic books out there, which I think, you know, deserve to have the light shine on them.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
So at the recent Fan Expo San Francisco, a number of Star Wars guests there. One of them was Vanessa Marshall, and she discussed, for some reason, the character of Mara Jade and how she would love to see a future for that character on screen, and maybe she'd like to play the role herself. She said, I would love to play Mara Jade. So she's basically saying she'd like to play
Mara Jade.
Can you call Dave Filoni and just let him know that I'd love to play Mara Jade? I think we'd all like to be in live action in some way. I think she's talking about her vocal compatriots.
Yeah.
We haven't had the opportunity to do it yet, but my background is in live action, so she's kind of half tongue-in-cheek, half seriously putting it out there that she'd love to be in live action. And maybe she's the right person for Mara Jade, maybe she's not, but do you think, it's a broader question, do you think there's a future for a character like Mara? Because we've had plenty of other characters come in from the Empire trilogy. We had the Nogri in Rebels, we've had a load of other characters turn up in various guises, and of course Thrawn's just returned in Ahsoka. So what do you think? Do you think there's a possibility of that?
I suppose the thing is, as you kind of said, the problem is with Mara is like a lot of her backstory as it stands could still stand, but then there's a big chunk of what we know of a character has basically been kind of superseded and retconned really by obviously canon. That's just the nature of what happens with expanded universe and stuff like that. So I think it's possible. She's a fan favourite. I think, you know, there's an interesting character that we could do a lot with. You know, she's got some nuance there, and I like the whole kind of like dark side, light side, which I don't really think we've got many characters at the moment who could walk that line in such a delicate kind of way like she does.
Do you think, though, that with a character like hers, where you would essentially have to gut the character that people know and just take the basics of it and move it forward in this canon realm, do you think that would work? Because, as you say, you had the version of her that we first met in Heir to the Empire and that trilogy, and then she moves into different facets of her life all the way through to the end. Do you think it would work if they just took a portion of it and, I don't know, didn't have her marry Luke Skywalker, let's say, and just try and do it in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, well, to be fair, that's the kind of part that you probably could still do, actually, to some degree.
I think
that would be quite interesting. I still like the whole notion of her kind of being like a dancer in Jabba's palace. And there's so many different ways that Timothy Zahn kind of really did work hard to kind of like fit her in to the original trilogy. But obviously there are some big things that you just wouldn't have. But at the same time, even the whole Vendetta, there's absolutely nothing to say that she could have been hiding out in the galaxy for 10, 15 years with this chip on her shoulder, this Vendetta. And we could see her actually try and take on Luke Skywalker in that Mandalorian era, kind of post-ROTJ. Yep. So it's possible.
And with the voice actors on that point, nobody's owed anything. All these voice actors are hired to be the voice of a character. They're not hired to be the face of a character. Otherwise, you'd clearly pick different actors, wouldn't you? But in some instances, it works. And in some instances, you bring an actor in like Katie Sackhoff, who they can then, as a known actor in that fandom, make the character look like her, and maybe one day in the future it works. Do you think that these actors, nobody's owed anything, but do you think they deserve a role in live action?
I mean, some may deserve a shot. I suppose it all comes down to, like, you know, you take Katie Sackhoff, who's an actor who did a voice role basically as a cameo in Clone Wars, and so her acting shots are more on screen. I've always assumed that Vanessa Marshall was a voice character actor. We know that she's a huge Star Wars fan. That's always a benefit, because you sometimes get those actors going the extra mile for their roles. However, she's great as Hera, and she does a number of other voices throughout the galaxy in gaming and
for you guys a celebration.
And for us a celebration as well, yeah. So, you know, that which not many people know, so yeah. But they're not owed anything, and to be fair, they were probably made more household names through their work in Star Wars. I don't want to say it, but they're probably at the events like these conventions more at the grace of stars because of what they've done rather than what they do with the rest of their body of work. So it's kind of like, you know, they're not really owed. However, it's whether or not, you know, we think actually Vanessa would make a good Mara Jade. And then, like you said, we've had a good positive response from Casey Sackhoff as Bo-Katan, not so positive response potentially with Lars Mikkelsen. So can go either way, really, can't it? It's down to the casting, and I think as long as the casting is not done as a stunt, then why not? just to give listeners a bit of a visual kind of cue, we're actually recording this in the changing room for Rebel Legion of UK Garrison. So if you can hear the sound of plastic and Velcro ripping off, that's people changing. But our good friend and regular, maybe serial listener and question asker, Mr. Skywalker is here. So basically the question was, did you watch Rebels? Did Star Wars Rebels? Yeah, so Vanessa Marshall, who does the voice of Hera, she has basically kind of come out at a convention and said, you know, I'd quite like to be Mara Jade. So the question really is, one, do you think Vanessa would make a good live-action Mara Jade? But also, do we think that these voice actors, are they owed anything? Should they get, like, preferential treatment to be casted?
I don't think they're owed anything, because, I mean, they've already got one gig in Star Wars. I don't think they're owed another just because they've done the first one. And as for her specifically, if Luke's going to be in his 50s, or you know, how old is the character compared to how old Luke Skywalker is, if they're going to be together, you know what I mean?
Because, they've always felt like they were kind of like they were peers, really, weren't they? They were, similar age.
But Luke would better be in his 30s at this time.
Yeah.
So if it's going to be set in the Mandoverse as it is now, she possibly could be too old. That's the only thing that springs to mind. So I'd probably say look for another actress.
Hi, this is Guy Henry and you're listening to Fantha Tracks. Enjoy.
With the arrival of Ahsoka on Disney Plus, it's now completed, of course. You can watch the whole thing right now. Dave Filoni has talked about Hayden Christensen, obviously back as Anakin Skywalker, first in Obi-Wan Kenobi, now in Ahsoka. And I think he's referring to the fact that they've both had long histories with Star Wars, but of course Hayden with the Anakin character. And Dave says it was kind of amazing to have somebody who had this experience too, who would know the things I was talking about related to Anakin and how George saw him. We really understood each other and the language of it. We discussed how this isn't really a story about Anakin, but it's important to see how Ahsoka sees Anakin. This is her lived experience. His story is already told and George's saga is done, but this is important for her because you're her mentor. It gave me pause just to stand there and look at him in the costume, standing next to Ariana Greenblatt, because in my mind it really is no different. No matter what the medium is, the image is always Anakin with Ahsoka, that older brother, younger sister dynamic. So two people who understand each character very well. Obviously, Filoni couldn't know Ahsoka better. And Anakin, played by Hayden, obviously is very familiar to that actor. So that dynamic, bringing the live-action Anakin into the, essentially into a live-action version of the animated world, which is where Filoni does most of his work. It's a bit meta, but what do you think? it seems kind of cool to be able to, because not that long ago, you would never imagine Filoni and Hayden having really anything to do with it, because Filoni had already got his Anakin Skywalker. It was Matt Lanter, so it's interesting to put the two together.
And I suppose probably the common denominator is going to be George, really. You know, because as you said, there's probably no one who will know what George was thinking about Anakin as well as, well, both of them, really.
Yeah.
And probably from slightly different perspectives. You know, you think Dave Filoni would be talking to George about how Anakin is responding to his Padawan and the events of the Clone Wars.
And the motivations.
The motivations. And therefore, you've got Anakin, who's played by Hayden Christensen, and obviously George is talking to him about the loss and about like the emotive aspects of the pressure of what that character actually is, and how he kind of, how much pressure is on him in the galaxy, and how much pressure he's putting on himself, and the struggles that he has with obviously attachments and Padme. So I bet it was probably quite an interesting conversation, you know, and like you said, one we probably wouldn't have expected to have had like 2 or 3 years ago.
And for Hayden as well, because he plays Anakin in Attack of the Clones for the first time, and you've got the young bratty teenage Anakin who's kind of awkward and a bit out of sorts.
Yeah.
And then you step forward 3 years in real time and screen time to the Revenge of the Sith Anakin, who's been through all the stuff that Dave has just directed Hayden in 20 years later.
Yeah,
going through all the stuff that Filoni oversaw, that Clone Wars era. But as you say, having had the year of Lucas and understanding the motivations and then been able to focus on the performance as well. So I guess that's where the two meet halfway, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And from it's trying to fine-tune that balance of Anakin versus Sith Anakin and Darth Vader Anakin, and trying to find kind of like where the three kind of like overlap and how they overlap. And obviously they did that so well in Ahsoka with like the voiceovers and like the visualization with like, you know, flicking to Vader's silhouettes. And but it's trying to kind of find that right, you know, the right placing of Anakin at those different points in time.
I suppose when you think to Obi-Wan Kenobi, which is halfway between New Hope and Revenge of the Sith, that's kind of happening in real time. That's actually what happens. This is, as Dave says, this is Ahsoka's lived experience. It's her remembering, her thinking back. It's in the world between worlds. So it's not necessarily exactly how it happened. There are almost looks at the camera, fourth wall breaking. It's not reality. It's a remembrance of reality. But nevertheless, it's as close as we're ever likely to get. So to be able to tell those, I'm thinking of Hayden's point of view, be able to be Anakin again in those two time periods must have been, well, what a treat.
Yeah. And also you think about Anakin dueling with Obi-Wan in the Kenobi series and that flashback as well. You know, so he's been a lucky boy because he's managed to get in into these different time eras and these different aspects of all these other characters. And, you know, he's been used as a really nice vehicle to kind of emphasise other character aspects of Obi-Wan and of Ahsoka.
And it's interesting, Filoni says this isn't really a story about Anakin, but it's important to see how Ahsoka sees Anakin.
Yeah.
Up until this point, every time you've seen Anakin or Vader, that guy is the focal point. You know, the original trilogy, really, if you think about it, and the prequel trilogy, that is Anakin's story.
Yeah.
Luke almost comes into it, if you watch it as a whole now, in the correct order, Luke kind of comes into it and other characters come into it. But the thread is
Anakin.
Is Anakin's rise point, and fall. Yeah. Now, to have him be the B player, if you like, in somebody else's story, because this is Ahsoka's story now. The switch there is quite interesting as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we even see that with the cinematography. You know, there's a lot of forced angles and looking up from her perspective to Anakin and stuff, and, you know, seeing all those lovely shots of them framed together and the height difference and stuff. And I think it's great that you can take these characters and have this through story, like you said, with Vader, and then kind of go, like, we're going to just turn this 180 degrees, turn the camera literally 180 degrees and focus it onto Ahsoka and see how her perspective is shaping her destiny and her reaction to Anakin and Anakin's fall as well.
And because there's been so many gaps in the whole story of Darth Vader, and it's always felt like you assume stuff and there's enough about what's going on that you kind of fill in the gaps. We're now in a period of Star Wars where you can either do a comic or a book or now a TV show and telling you these gaps, and you don't have to guess it, you can be told it. Do you welcome that? Do you think that loses a bit of the mystique of Vader as a character, or do you want to know it?
Do you know what? It's a double-edged sword, because the complaint, but also the praise that I had with the Marvel Darth Vader comic series, is that he does dwell a lot on Padme. I think the difficult thing is that because it's filling in that time frame, and we don't really get any kind of hint of that in the original trilogy. No. The redemption,
he's focused,
he's focused, and then the redemption is through his son, but never the mother is spoken about. No. And you kind of think, God, you know, if they just slipped in just one random line, that would have just tied that prequel trilogy, like...
What, even like a special edition or something?
Something like that, yeah. Or, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? It's all 4-4, and this is the problem when you kind of shoot out of order. I liked the trials that Vader went on with the Emperor. I liked the notion that the Emperor was there and he kind of, like, he smashed him down. He drove him into the ground and then kind of, like, let him build himself back up and kind of find his own way in the dark side. There are some aspects I think is nice to be able to see, but also I think there's some stuff I think you keep a mystery. You don't need to see everything all the time.
If you want to be part of the action, visit FanthaTracks.com or be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at FanthaTracks. Send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our making tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, on Facebook, YouTube and Twitch, and check out our FanthaTracks Radio Friday night rotation every Friday at 7 o'clock UK time for new episodes of The Phantom from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks, and every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, FanthaTracks.com, our social media feeds, FanthaTracks TV and FanthaTracks Radio are absolutely free. So no Patreon, Buy Me a Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news.
Until we catch up with you again, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.
I'm all about the ambience. I love all the plastic crunches.
I hate having people listen and watch me talk basically.
Right, we'll stay for a longer listen.
Yeah.